Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Warm Sabbath greetings to you all. Pleasure to have a chance to be here today, especially on such a lovely spring day. Isn't it amazing? Feels like a spring day. My wife sends her greetings. Unfortunately, she is just at the tail end of some kind of bug that has got her down, and she felt by coming today it might still be communicable. So in a state of loving kindness, she decided to stay at home for today. But she did want to pass along her greetings. Truly a historic moment by coincidence that just yesterday there was a transition and a new direction for America. Much fanfare, much to-do, and a focus on two individuals, one passing the baton, the next claiming now to bear a torch of make America great again. But can he? How much can one man do? It's astonishing that he has the lowest favorability rating for an incoming president in recent memory, but at the same time, the optimism is at an all-time high. Something like 65% are very optimistic about the future of America. But to be clear, it is God who sets up kings. I trust Mr. D is actually doing the Daniel series here in the congregation. So in Daniel 2, Daniel was asked by King Nebuchadnezzar to reveal to him not only the meaning of his dream, but the dream itself. And Daniel asked for time, went to his friends to say, please pray for me for guidance. And he came back, and in Daniel 2, verse 21, he says, and it is he, that is God, who changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. Further in Romans, you may wish to jot down Romans 13:1. Let every soul be subject to governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. But as I was preparing this message, I thought, there's a tsunami coming. Tsunami is a very interesting phenomenon, because as it travels along the sea, it's virtually undetectable until it comes close to land, when it can rise up, and in some rare instances in Hawaii, one instance where it actually rose to the height of 1,700 feet. But undetectable as it's traveling along under the surface of the water. Well, I thought for today's message, we need to take a step back to have a big picture snapshot of where the nation is, but not just the nation, but even the direction of the Western world. And for that, let's turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy 3. Many, if not all, of the scriptures today will be quite familiar. We've heard them many times, but they are nevertheless strikingly true. 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 to 5, we have a description of the end days. We read in verse 1, but know this, in the last days perilous times will come. Men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy. The list goes on. Unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such turn away. So that in itself is a very descriptive picture of the times we're in, but I went to another translation. I'm enjoying going to other translations these days. In the Living Translation, we're not setting doctrine here, but rather it's even more vivid. I thought it was worth reading again. Same words. You have to realize, in the last days, these times will be full of danger. Men will be utterly self-centered, greedy for money, full of big words. They will be proud, contemptuous, without any regard for what parents have taught them, utterly lacking in gratitude, purity, or normal human affections. They will be men of unscrupulous speech, have no control of themselves. They'll be passionate but unprincipled, treacherous, self-willed, conceited, loving all the time what gives them pleasure instead of loving God. They will maintain a facade of religion, but their conduct denies its validity. You must keep clear of people like this. So we look not just to leadership, but rather the overall direction of the country, as well as the tenor of the times, the society itself. And I recalled a story from Mr. Herbert Armstrong, who, back in his early days, writing his biography, talked about an economist named Roger Babson, not well known today, But he quoted from this economist who, in the early part of January 1920, there was post-war prosperity, and he went to a conference and said that there was going to be the worst business depression our age has experienced. And they laughed, they scoffed at him at the time. And yet, just a short time later, in fact, a flash of downturn of the market did take place. And Mr. Armstrong quoted this man, Mr. Babson, at another conference and said, well, how did you know this? He said, well, now it's midwinter. If I want to know the temperature is now in this room, I go to the wall, I look at the thermometer. If I want to know what it has been up to now and the existing trend of the moment, I look at a recording thermometer. But if I want to know what the temperature in the room is going to be 1 hour from now, I go to the source, which determines future temperatures, down to the boiler room, and see what's happening down there. And then he goes on to criticize. He says, you gentlemen have bank clearings, indexes of business activity, stock car loadings, etc., etc. But I looked at the way people as a whole were dealing with one another, and I looked to the source that determines future conditions. I found that that source may be defined in terms of, and this harkens back to some of the comments from Mr. Morrison, that they can be defined in terms of righteousness. If 51% of the people or more are reasonably righteous in their dealings with others, we're heading to increasing prosperity. When 51% of the people become unrighteous in business dealings, we're headed for bad times economically. Now, economics is just one lens that we can look at the health of a nation, a society, or even a civilization. So I thought it was worth considering another civilization. And this one, too, was an overextended empire. In fact, it was roughly equivalent physically to the size of the United States. And they had become almost by accident the policemen of the world. Of course, I'm talking about the Roman Empire. And how were the Romans very much similar to the modern Western society today? And those similarities are striking. Yet, the lessons have not been learned. So I've recently been considering a piece of literature which I have borrowed from a friend, and this actually, the modern Romans. How many of you have actually read through the modern Romans, perhaps? Yeah, a number of you have. And this was the very first piece of literature I ever received from the Church of God. I was actually a teenager in high school at the time. And it was published in 72 and then republished again in 1975. So more than 40 years ago. It doesn't say if it was authored specifically by Mr. Herbert Armstrong. More than likely a team of writers authored it. But I thought it was rather telling because even despite it being 40 years old, it's no less true today. In fact, the message is even stronger today. So the question that comes up, are we following the same path as the Roman Empire? Are we, in fact, the modern Romans? So this message truer today than in the past. So I thought that we would take some pieces of reference and see how things changed. Are they better? Are they worse? Are they much the same as when this was written? So I'll be quoting extensively from that. But first, just an overview of the power of this Roman Empire. At its peak, which was roughly in the early 100s AD, the empire stretched as far north as Scotland, stretched through Europe into Asia, as far as the border between modern-day Iraq and Iran. It had southern borders extending to North Africa. And at its height, it actually had a stake, a military stake, a trading stake, in 48 different countries. And then after reaching its peak in the hundreds, it faced a slow decline before losing most of its territory during the 5th century, collapsing in 476 AD. But that legacy of the Roman Empire still exists with us. Much of our language is from the Latin language. Their architecture, their religion, in fact, we think of the Vatican, still is with us today. And the average citizen of Rome said, how could this great nation crumble? It's impregnable. It has an unstoppable military machine. Wealth like the world has never known. Indeed, they felt that the whole world was Rome. Fate had decreed they would always be on top. Today, I'm not going to say the parallels with the decline and fall of the Romans are exact, but the lessons of Rome shouldn't be lost on us, especially during what is a momentary peace. to quote, can you continue quoting from the modern Romans, to speculate at the moment of unsurpassed material and economic and military achievements that glorious Rome could collapse to inferior barbarians, if you wish you could insert the word ISIS here, it was unthinkable. What Roman Jeremiah could have prophesied that ravages of war, taxation, mounting crime, race problems, moral decay, subversion from within, political assassinations, public apathy, not to exclude natural disasters, such as the drought in California, would one day bring Rome prostrate before less developed nations. It was Christian in name at the end of the 5th century, but it did not have divine protection from the barbarians that overran her. No nation that fails to fully respect and live by God's true moral standards ever does. And I'll put as an insert, Mr. Trump, in his inauguration address, perhaps most profound statement, more than he could realize just 24 hours ago, we will be protected by God. Will we? How does he know that? Let's continue with the quotation. Back to ancient Rome. Prodigious engineering projects, high-rise buildings, theater and cosmetic arts, spectator sports, sightseers, tourism, all words used to describe Rome in the 2nd century AD at the height of its power, a roadway system, a network that was equivalent to 5 times around the equator of the earth, has not been rivaled until very modern times. According to historian Dr. Robert Strauss Hoop, if at any time in human history a people could have looked confidently to the future, it was the Roman people of the 2nd century. Yet within 100 years, this same author notes, Rome was plunged into anarchy and poverty, ravaged by foreign aggressors, and doomed to extinction. What lessons then can we learn from the experience of Rome? None, if we think that the society we're in now is different, completely different from those of the ancient Romans. If we ignore these parallels with the average pleasure-seeking Roman, one can scarcely imagine how this proud and mighty nation could be brought down low before. So there are 4 points, and many more I could touch on, but the 4 I thought I would cull from this book, The Modern Romans, would be the economic situation, the military power, a chapter titled The Mad Craze for Pleasure, and finally, the destruction of the family. So first we have the economy in trouble. Rome had extended itself, becoming by accident as much as by design, the dominant nation of the world. The cost of maintaining what was called the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, over most of the known world, was just proving too great even for the enormous resources of this great empire. Rome attempted a policy of unrestricted trade, but the Roman working man was unable to compete with the cheap foreign labor and demanded high tariffs. As we're going through this, I hope you'll see the parallels even within the news and our daily headlines. The government was finally forced to subsidize Roman's working class to make up the difference between the real wages, that is the actual value of what they produced, and the wages required to keep up their high standard of living. So everyone has their plasma TV, even though they may not be able to pay rent. Just as in America and Britain today, spiraling wage increases are helping to cause inflation and pricing American goods out of the world market. Now remember, this was written 40 years ago. Is it less true or more true today? Lower cost imports threatening the domestic market. As a result, thousands of workmen living on a subsidy did nothing whatever and they sacrificed their standard of living just for a life of ease. The costs of running this gigantic empire were massive. It took almost an army of administrators to maintain the economy, of officials to man to work the complicated system of supply and demand, not only for the government but also for the military. It necessitated laying further heavy burdens of taxation upon already overburdened people. I know, I live close to Cook County. No stone was left unturned for revenues. There were other aggravating problems of revenue. Rising prices, loss of money's purchasing power, the escape of the rich from taxation, the poor growing poorer, the decline of production, soil exhaustion and drought, disease epidemics decimating the provinces, and expensive wars shook and violently shook, weakened the superstructure of this empire. Now, America's copper-nickel sandwich coins are just such a sign of economic deterioration. But look at Rome's experience. By the third quarter of the third century, the silver coins had become copper pieces, just washed with silver. Issues of gold had stopped. There was a vast inflation. By the end of the third century, prices had risen to 200 times the second century level. We haven't hit that point yet, but since 2000, our dollar has lost 40%. So a dollar today is only worth 60 cents compared to the year 2000. And in fact, from the time this book, The Modern Romans, was written, the inflation has been between 75 and 80%. Diocletian, one of the emperors of Rome, attempted to set price controls and utterly failed. Quote, "There is seen only a mad desire without control to pay no heed to the needs of the many." Hopefully there's a respite from that in the future. Another significant factor contributed to the breakdown of the character and spirit of the populace was welfare. The dole became the way of life. At times, the city of Rome had from one-third to one-half of the population receiving part or all its subsistence from public charity. And it's not just us, but in the country of Greece, one out of three people is a government worker. Little wonder why that country is just on the brink, and continually on the brink. Now from a news source, CNSnews.com, with the title, "The 35.4%. As of the fourth quarter of 2012, 109 million plus Americans lived in households receiving benefits that are from federally funded means-tested programs, also called welfare. Now, this is the same as the population of Texas, New York, Florida, and California combined. When those receiving benefits from non-means-tested federal programs, that including Social Security, Medicare, unemployment, were added, it turned out that there were something in the range of 153 million people getting federal benefits of some kind. So of the 153 million, this equals approximately 49.5% of the population. We can do some finagling with others who might not be counted, but that number actually is the equivalent of the population of Russia. In the fourth quarter of 2008, when Mr. Obama was elected, there were 96 million people living in households taking benefits from one or more federal welfare programs. 4 years later, fourth quarter of 2012, that had grown to 13 million. Now, in 1902, the total bill for taxes of all kinds in the U.S. amounted to $18 per capita. That's 1902. 1948, risen to $377. 1960, $709. 1968, $1,000. That seems pretty modest now, doesn't it? Writes historian William Stearns Davis in a book, The Influence of Wealth in Imperial Rome. As an almost unavoidable corollary of the huge Roman fortunes went the accumulation of debts. Even men of grave and respectable habits caught the mania in their age, that of living beyond their means. The typical Roman of birth and fashion may then be imagined as regularly in debt, frequently on the brink of ruin, and the average American recently, it was stated, I didn't find the actual source of the report, could not come up with $500 if an emergency struck. If an engine went out on the car or some other emergency took place, they would not have $500 at their disposal. That's the majority of people in America. And so the book continues, the average American's in the same sinking financial boat. Total debt in the United States, and they present this as a horrific figure, stands at an astronomical $2.7 trillion. Now, I think you probably know, that's a relatively small sum because, and I looked up the debt clock, it's very worthwhile. You can actually just type it in, look at the debt clock and see the numbers ticking upwards. The debt clock stands at $19.962 trillion, and estimates are from the Bipartisan Policy Institute Center in Washington that it will click up to the $20 trillion figure next month, $20 trillion. And I thought it might be of interest. I heard a description once, which was very valuable, of what a trillion consists of, because it's a little bit difficult to conceive these numbers. And the narrator of this said that if you took $100 bills and stacked them, you know, a stack an inch tall, you could imagine $100 bills. We'd probably like that 1 inch. Well, if you actually extended that up to 7 feet tall, a stack 7 feet tall, and then you multiplied stacks of 7 foot tall $100 bills in a football stadium, and you lined the stadium from end zone to end zone so that it was full from sideline to sideline, end zone to end zone, with these 7 foot tall stacks of $100 bills, that's approximately a trillion. So imagine 20 stadiums. That's the debt America owes as of next month. So I think at that point it's good to switch over to Deuteronomy and a very well-known series of scriptures, Deuteronomy in chapter 28. As I'm sure you well recall, the blessings and the cursings. Deuteronomy 28, and starting in verse 1. Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord God will set you high above all nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. Now we'll skip on down because we have a long list of those blessings, but skipping down to, I believe it's verse 9. The Lord will establish you as a holy people to himself, just as he's sworn to you. So once he's sworn by himself, he cannot change. He must fulfill the promise. It's conditional. If you keep the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways, then all peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you. The Lord will grant you plenty of goods in the fruit of your body, the increase of your livestock, the produce of your ground, the land which the Lord swore to your fathers to give you. The Lord will open to you his good treasure, the heavens, to give the rain to your land in its season, to bless all the work of your hand. You shall lend, this is probably the high point verse, you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. How long has it been since that has been the case? That America has no need to borrow. This concept is repeated in Deuteronomy 15, verses 4 to 6. And here we read a remarkable statement. Deuteronomy 15, verse 4 says, of that time, there will be no poor among you. There will be no poor among you. You won't go down to downtown Chicago and be accosted every 50 yards by someone begging on the street. It wouldn't be necessary. For the Lord, and for is really because, the Lord will greatly bless you in the land which the Lord is giving you to possess as an inheritance. And he repeats it, only if you carefully obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe with care all these commandments which I command you today, for the Lord your God will bless you just as he promised you. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. You shall reign over many nations, but they shall not reign over you. That's rather a longer section, but there was rather a lot of material in it. With that, I think we can move on to the whole concept, which comes from one of the chapters in this Modern Romans, which is militarism. Now, I quote from the Modern Romans the following. In a military age, at the time of the ancient Romans, surrounded by nations becoming more aggressive, hostile, treacherous, Rome followed a policy that made her increasingly weaker defensively and more vulnerable to conquest. I think you'll find this very interesting. She thought her policies of defense would make her stronger, and for a while they did, but in the end, they destroyed her. The U.S. as a world power is facing perilous, dangerous times. We look at Iran and the, I can only call it foolhardy, contract that was made by the past Secretary of State, Mr. Kerry, under Mr. Obama's administration. They continue to have their hidden nuclear facilities, no curtailment whatsoever of a ballistic missile development program. Absurd that that would not be included, and yet it was not. We could skip over then to North Korea. North Korea making the statement that they would be testing long-range ballistic missiles, and it's widely understood by various sources this will take place within the next several months. Interesting to note, Mr. Trump tweeted, you know, you can actually do searches of his tweets. It's amazing what you can find. So I searched for his answer. He says, North Korea just stated it's in the final stages of developing a nuclear weapon capable of reaching parts of the U.S. It won't happen. How does he know that? What leverage does America have over Kim Jong-un, a man who is certifiably insane? There's no doubt, he is insane. But he's insane for his own benefit. And he will most certainly launch that test rocket. Now, this comes up to, well, we could continue on. The islands of the South China Sea, armed with missile batteries, clearly they're becoming an expansive power, testing the will of America. Similarly, the Roman Empire was ringed by a wall of fortress. Now, we think of Korea, we think of Japan, and there are voices now that are calling both within Japan, and even Mr. Trump has alluded to the idea that Japan should go nuclear. It's a nation I'm well acquainted with, having spent a number of years there, and I have little doubt that they could become a full-fledged nuclear power within about 6 months. It would probably only take that long because of their current state of technology. Similarly, and I'll come to this a little bit later, he's even said to Germany, well, let's make Germany a nuclear power. Imagine the two great powers that were the enemies of America in World War II, and the current administration is saying, well, let's let them take care of their own defense. Where will that lead? So the Roman Empire was ringed by its wall of fortresses on the Rhine, the Danube, the Euphrates, Arabia, Africa. We may not think of these parts of the world, but this is roughly the size of the United States. Even Hadrian's Wall in Britain. And America, likewise, has an unsinkable alliance, an unshakable friend in Japan and in Korea. Well, do we? Alliances change. So we continue on. The loss of military alliances, is this alluding to Rome or to America? The loss of military alliances, and this is because of an increasing distrust of America becoming an isolationist power. The speech yesterday, which I hope most of you had a chance to at least listen to the highlights of it, Mr. Trump was unequivocal in saying that in every one of his decisions will be inward-looking. Every one of them will take care of America first. Is this not very similar to the situation just prior to World War II, where there are calls for isolationism from many quarters before America finally was attacked at Pearl Harbor? So now I'd like to come up to a woman by the name of Angela, let's first give a little more background because I think it's very interesting. Mr. Trump has said he has a vision for the national security. Here it is. 90,000 more army soldiers, a 350 ship navy, 100 more fighter jets, strengthen nuclear and missile defenses. And defense experts said these plans will cost about $100 billion more than the Pentagon is currently budgeted for Trump's first term. So in those 4 years, $100 billion more. An amount that would require Congress to change laws setting budget caps for the Pentagon. Still unknown, however, and this actually comes from a news feed, where will that money come from, given Mr. Trump's other plans? He says he will slash taxes and at the same time will then build up the military. How will he keep the entitlement programs intact while embarking on a $1 trillion infrastructure improvement program? The numbers do not seem to add up. And longtime budget analyst Todd Harrison from a place called the Center for Strategic International Studies, I see big deficits in our future. The question remains, where will the ability to afford such a military come from? And Rome faced the same question. Now, we shouldn't turn away from England. I read recently of England that if they were to go into a war such as even the one down in the Falklands, if you remember back in 1981, that they couldn't bring it off, that they would not have a military capable. In fact, the Lancet missile, they're actually being put out of power and they're not planning on to replace them. So in other words, they virtually do not have a military or a navy in England to defend if they were attacked. So it doesn't apply just to America. Oh, but on the lighter side, there is some good news. I don't know if you recall the bust of Winston Churchill, and that bust was returned under Mr. Obama. Do you all know about that? That it was a present from England to America, and Mr. Obama returned it. Mr. Trump has asked for it back. Isn't that interesting? He said, can we have it back again? Because he wants it in the White House. I thought that was rather a nice point. All right, so let's continue on with a quote that comes from, I'm not sure if you're familiar with a man named Charles Krauthammer. Charles Krauthammer, I enjoy listening to very much. He has an insight and a way of really punching through and pinpointing issues that I just envy. He made this statement after the inauguration. I want to make a point about this speech. A part we overlooked, I'm sure, is not being overlooked around the world. There are two audiences for inaugural speeches, domestic and foreign. And I guarantee you they are quaking in their boots in foreign capitals, particularly our allies and our trading partners. The way that Trump spoke about the outside world was the most aggressive, hyper-nationalist, and in some ways most hostile of any inaugural address since perhaps World War II. And now, because I try to keep up on news in Germany, I ran across something which really you hardly hear of in America. And Ms. Merkel, who is really on the ropes politically, the Chancellor of Germany, and a date to watch, September 24th of next year. September 24th, there will be a new German government in place. And it's very unlikely that Angela Merkel, who has led that country for well over a decade, it's very unlikely she will be leading Germany. But she was given an honorary doctorate just last week, and during her doctoral speech, I'll paraphrase, she said, "We must come to terms with a new reality that traditional alliances and support for we Europeans can no longer be counted on. We ourselves must learn to count on our own union." And the background to that is there are many, many calls across Europe to develop their own allied military. There are talks right now with France and Germany to develop a true alliance. And in that context, it's amazing that some would say, well, let them go nuclear. That's just, you know, they should take care of themselves. Der Spiegel, which is the mirror, one of the major magazines of Germany, said, "The Chancellor is fully aware of what's at stake. If Mr. Trump carries out part of what he promised, then the world order, as Germany knows it, would be relegated to the dustbin of history. The messages from Ms. Merkel's emissaries have been given by Trump's people so far have not been encouraging. They reported the new president will make his decision based solely on domestic policy. His foreign policy will be dictated by how his decisions will be seen at home. And my statement is that the pieces of the puzzle seem to be falling into place. May we be seeing a forced emergence, or re-emergence rather, the 10th and the final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire." I'm not saying that is the case, but it's what we are to watch. And with that, back to the modern Romans. Our third topic is called a mad craze for pleasure. And they do get shorter, by the way. So this one a little bit less, but speaking of ancient Rome, the writers said, "Indulge yourself. You owe it to yourself. Live it up now. As many as can, do. And those who cannot do so, literally do so vicariously through unending access to entertainment." Now, this is talking about Rome. "In an age of selfish materialism, few seriously question whether all this rapid consumption of indulgences is really good for them or where it will lead. What does the history of Rome teach about such trends? A Roman historian explains, the Pax Romana brought many blessings, made possible the greatest of luxuries, the most active commercial life the world ever saw. And what were Rome's highest social values and goals? It was the excessive desire for wealth without regards to method or to duty toward posterity. Downright sensuality. The economic evil was at the bottom. First, Italy, which was a vast empire, devoted itself for centuries to a feverish effort to get money by any means and to spend that money on selfish enjoyments. And so what do we see today? Happiness is, buy this car. You have this car. Look how happy your life will be. Upgrade to the new high-definition TV. There was a poll done amongst young people, and no surprise, young people up to their early 30s, no surprise, what is their greatest desire? Fame and wealth. Fame and wealth, that was their number one desire. And I was rather pleased to see a rather surprising quotation from the comedian Jim Carrey. Some people say I look like Jim Carrey. I don't think that's true, but if I do, he's rich, but I'm better looking. Anyway. Jim Carrey said, "I hope all of those young people get the fame and riches that they're after so they can realize that's not where happiness lies." I'm proud of him for saying that. The noted historian Edward Gibbon commented on this pleasure-crazed ruin of the Roman character in his famous book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. from the morning to the evening. Spectators who sometimes amounted to 400,000. I got a chance to go to the Rose Bowl many, many years ago, which seats 100,000. I was really blown away by the size of it. But the Circus Maximus could seat 400,000 people. Just a massive complex for charioteer races. 400,000, their eyes fixed on the horses, and the happiness of Rome appeared to hang on the event of a race. And is that very different from eager buyers sleeping overnight in front of ticket offices to buy World Series or Super Bowl tickets? Sports heroes with their multi-million dollar salaries. A number of years back, a rather second tier, one of the Major League Baseball players, his contract, a 15, 20-year contract. It was a five-year contract. So his five-year contract was probably triple or quadruple what I would earn in my entire lifetime. Working a full 30 years, and his was triple in just 5 years. Good gig if you can get it. So they have their multi-million dollar salaries, gambling mania. You know, there are some people in the country who believe their only path to get out of debt will be winning the lottery. That will be their only path. The only way they're going to become wealthy. Skipping to different topics, deaths from heroin in the United States. And this is all under the mad craze for pleasure. The United States is struggling with an epidemic, with the number of users reaching a 20-year high, according to a United Nations report. Heroin-related deaths also increased. Apparently, there are about 1 million users of heroin in the United States, three times the number of 2003. So in a little over a decade, it's grown to a million people, many times young people. And it's the researcher quoted named Angela May, said it's the highest definitely in the last 20 years, stressing that this trend is continuing. And in addition to the heroin deaths, there have also been a surge in death by something called fentanyl. Fentanyl, I've never heard of that. I don't know if anyone has heard of fentanyl before. But you probably heard of Prince. That's how Prince died. He died of fentanyl. And that is a drug that is 50 to 100 times stronger than morphine. 50 to 100 times stronger. And now we come to the fourth and the most telling feature of the decline of the Roman Empire, and that is the breakdown of the family. Many years ago, a book came out which was Why Marriage Soon Obsolete. And I looked at that and I said, well, what's that talking about? No one in my acquaintanceship was actually of a broken household. And other things that were mentioned in this, such as the rise of GTSO, GTBL, you know what I'm talking about, the gay lesbian. Okay, so yeah, we have a club at my school. They call themselves the Gay Straight Alliance, the GSA. And they were celebrated yesterday as one of many groups, the chess team, the debate team, and here's the Gay Straight Alliance coming with their flag of multicolors, walking around the auditorium of our school. When I read about that in the Modern Romans, the rise of homosexuality in the whole culture, I thought, what is that talking about? I was a teenager at the time and knew virtually, I think I met one person, my acquaintance, in all my years up in Western Canada, where my home is, that in all those years, just one single individual. So it was mind-boggling to see the change now. They call it, they add the Q at the end with the club in my school, which is for questioning. So I don't know if you know that. Very often you add not just lesbian, gay, et cetera, but also questioning. Those are questioning. Come join our club, because if you're not sure of your gender identification, maybe we can help you. I'd like to say I'm kidding you, but I'm absolutely not. This is true of high schools across the nation, across the entire nation. So, from a book called Why Marriage Matters by Glenn Stanton, this quotation actually is from Nobel laureate Gary Beck. The family in the Western world has been radically altered, some claim almost destroyed, by the events of the last three decades. So that's talking about just the last 30 years. Another Princeton historian says this: the scale of marital breakdown in the West since 1960 has no historical precedent. There has been nothing like it in the past 2,000 years, probably longer. And in 2002, Gallup took a values and beliefs survey. American views at that time of the morality of having a baby outside marriage that were favorable was 45%. In 2016, it had risen to 61%, so almost a percentage point per year, clicking upwards of nothing wrong, it's morally acceptable to have a child outside the marriage union. This is just bowing to the selfish concept that there ought to be, quote, sexual freedom without regard to consequences. The selfishness of bringing a child into the world without a mother and a father, the financial, the emotional, the social difficulties of life that are being foisted on those poor children is just a growing factor of life. It's just considered a factor of life. This man also writes of the danger of cohabitation, how it doesn't help marriage, in fact makes it more likely that divorce will occur. People say, oh, well, it's all, but you get to know each other if you do this before marriage. Well, I'm sorry, the research says otherwise. His statistics are strong and convincing. In fact, divorce is more likely in those cases. And this is the same when he speaks of the benefits for men and women when they get married, the problems of divorce and remarriage. By the time they're 20, one in four women aged 15 to 44 in the U.S. have lived with another man. By the time they're 30, that ratio climbs to three in four have lived with a man. What we see before our eyes is the foundation of society steadily eroding, the family, which from which stems the source of all values, loyalty and discipline and honor, are just crumbling. CNN reported cases of sexually transmitted diseases last year, more than ever before, according to the latest surveillance report from the CDC, Center for Disease Control. We have reached a decisive moment for the nation, Dr. Jonathan Merman, the director, said. In a written statement, STD rates are rising. Many of the country's systems for preventing STDs have eroded. We must mobilize, rebuild, and expand services, or the human and economic burden will continue to grow. So once again, what can one man do? Can he change the tenor of the times? So, what is the fuel for all this infidelity? It's my own analysis, but I think it's likely it's America's number one export. We all know what the number one export is. It's invaded homes and workplaces through the internet across the nation and around the world, and America provides 89% of it to the world. And that is, of course, pornography. 89% originates in the United States. Revenue is projected to be in the range of $2.84 billion for that so-called industry. America was called to be a city set on a hill, to provide a light and a beacon to the nations. Let's turn over to the book of Jeremiah in chapter 5. Jeremiah chapter 5 and verses 7 from 7 to 10. The writer says, "How shall I pardon you for this? Your children have forsaken me and sworn by those that are not gods. When I fed them to the full, then they committed adultery and assembled themselves by troops in the harlots' houses. They were like well-fed, lusty stallions. Everyone neighed after his neighbor's wife." Very expressive language. "Shall I not punish them for these things, says the Lord, and shall I not avenge myself on such a nation as this?" I looked up in another version, and this one is called The Message, but a very good translation. It says, "Why should I even bother with you anymore? Your children wander off and leave me. They take up with gods that are not gods. I satisfied their deepest needs, and then they went off to the sacred whores, left me for orgies in sex shrines, a bunch of well-groomed, lusty stallions, each one pawing and snorting for his neighbor's wife. Do you think I'm going to stand around and do nothing? God's decree, don't you think I'll take serious measures against the people like this?" I wonder if you've heard of Ashley Madison, or more rightly, the Ashley Madison Agency, which I'm ashamed to say is a Canadian-based online dating service. This is Wikipedia. A dating service and social networking service marketed to people who are married or who are in committed relationships. More rightly defined, it's a company that profiteers from the sizable market of adulterers seeking to hook up. No, as Solomon wrote, there's nothing new under the sun, only more imaginative ways to use technology to commit the same old sin. And Rome faced the similar erosion of family structure, but all was in vain. Now, quoting from the modern Romans, "The emperors resorted to penalties and bounties and deprivations and privileges and entreaties and expostulations. But the marriage state continued to be held in great disesteem. Amazing. In the same way, respect for marriage in the home is at the lowest ebb it's ever been in the United States and Britain and Canada and the English-speaking peoples around the world. Marriage to many means little or nothing. And in any society where marriage, which the Creator God intended to have utmost meaning, is treated so lightly, where a solid family relationship is no longer desired, that society is threatened with extinction. Rome traveled this road. It weakened that society. America, as well as Britain, and most of Western civilization is speeding along the same roadway. So in conclusion, a quotation from a man named Santayana in his book, The Life of Reason, written back in 1905. Now a very famous quotation, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." And what this brought up was from the book of Revelation. If you would like to turn there for our final scripture. As I said, we know these scriptures rather well, but it's in context of what is the direction of civilization going. Revelation 3. You may know exactly where we're going with this. Of late, I've had several good friends in the Church of God talk about how, yeah, this is it. It's the Laodicean era. Now, whether we want to call it by churches, by attitudes, by a literal time period or not, this is what is said in Revelation 3, verse 14, to the angel of the church of the Laodiceans. We're going to focus on one or two verses, but from verse 14, "These things says the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. I know your works. You're neither cold nor hot." So, is that our religious state? If we were to add more besides the mad craze for pleasure, military, we could add education, we could add religion, we could add terrorist threats. But he says, "I know your works. You're not cold, you're not hot. I could wish that you were cold or hot. So because you are lukewarm, neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth." And the focus on verse 17. "You say, I am rich. I have become wealthy. I have need of nothing." Is that the way that perhaps the United States is today? Feels, well, I have need of nothing. I remember talking to a Japanese man once, very distinguished professor. We went out for coffee together, and this person had spent some time in the United States, so he had quite good English. And got to talking about religion, and he says, and just point of fact, says, well, we Japanese don't need religion. It's not necessary. It's unimportant. And he really felt that. It's just unimportant. But he said, "But God says, you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. I counsel for you to me to buy gold refined in the fire that you may be rich. And you're naked. You need white garments. You need the garments of righteousness so that the shame of your nakedness would not be revealed." These are sobering words to consider as the administration of America changes and a new holder of the most powerful human office in the world takes charge. Already he's begun making promises of glory, claiming his own red lines in the sand. Will he be able to keep those promises with the nation heavily in debt, nationally and personally, while it's sinking deeper and deeper into its immorality? It's illuminated to note the meaning of the name Manasseh, from which the present-day United States has grown. Manasseh means forgetful. A researcher of Roman history, H.J. Haskell, said the following: "It required a century or more for the destructive forces in Rome to work out their effects. But the modern tempo is faster. The history of the later Roman Empire carries a warning to present-day Caesars and the society that they propose to lead."